It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
The evidence was circumstantial, and the prosecution brought Wayne Williams to trial for two of the 28 killings.
Apartments on Buford Highway, where we now have new developments in the ongoing investigation of the Centennial Park bombing.
General Robert Abrams, for the first time, had officially calls the Tawana Brawler story a lie.
At a press conference this morning, Seattle Police Chief Robert Hansen announced a special task force being formed to study Ted Bundy.
Join us now as we go beyond criminal headlines.
And I'm your host for Beyond Criminal Headlines, Nicole Bennett. Well, after another brief hiatus, thank you guys, as always, for your patience. I have a very unique episode this week. Recently, I had the incredible honor of speaking to a renowned dog handler who has spent decades tracking down serial killers and looking to recover missing persons. Tracy Sargent, who goes by Trace, joined me virtually over Zoom and talk about patience. She was so patient with me through a few technical difficulties on my end, but we powered through because, like I said, I was so excited to speak with her. And I should say Dr. Sargent, she now has a PhD. And in that vein, we began, of course, by talking about her background. And she said, sort of comically, years ago, she didn't know what end of the dog barked. She had no background in public safety or dog training, but she knew when she finished college, she wanted to get a dog and do something special with it. She just wasn't sure what that special thing was until fate intervened. She came across a Reader's Digest article about a woman who had a German Shepherd and found a missing 3-year-old child. And it was a light bulb moment for Trace.
And I was like, wow, if she can do it, I can do it too. Ironically, a year prior to that, I did do some research on the kind of dog that would really be a great fit for me. We had family dogs growing up, but I wanted something that would be the perfect dog for me. And I found that the German Shepherd was the perfect breed for a lot of reasons. And then, you know, fast forward a year later, and the pieces were starting to fall in, you know, into place. And one thing led to another, and I was like, oh my gosh, what if I actually find somebody and they're hurt? How do I take care of them? So that's when I became an EMT.
From there, Trace reached out to other canine handlers, mainly in law enforcement, of course, firefighters, emergency management, who let her spend time with them and train with them. And she couldn't help wondering, you guys get paid to have this much fun? So it was obviously a passion she never knew she had, and it would define the trajectory for the rest of her life. She went on to work in emergency management, become a firefighter, a police officer, a ham radio operator, master trainer in canine, and she said through all of that, all of the things she's done, her dogs have been the keystone to it all.
Even to this day, I have two working dogs, and not, that has not changed, even though maybe some other things in my life have changed. So that was the inspiration. That was really the seed that was planted. And that has led to this incredible journey and many, many adventures I've had with partners and so many incredible people over the years.
That's amazing. That's incredible. I underscore enough how much I admire what you do and have done in your field. And when you talk about canine officers, I don't know much about that field. And so for those listening who are kind of in my same boat, we don't know a lot about, you know, what makes a good canine handler, and what goes into training a canine officer and a cadaver dog?
I get that question quite a bit. And it's odd when I tell people this right off the bat. If you want to be a canine officer or handler, don't get a dog. And they're like, well, wait a minute. What? I don't understand. Well, let me explain. So first of all, there's a huge learning curve in doing this kind of work. And not the dog is certainly a big part of it, but just all the things I mentioned earlier, so far as first aid training, search training, equipment, logistics, incident command structures, just all of those variables that you can learn yourself without a dog. But also the more important part about that is that a dog and getting a dog is a long-term commitment. It is truly like a marriage and a relationship. So you want to make sure that you get the right dog that is perfect for you. For example, there may be a dog out there, and I've had a couple of dogs over the years that were amazing dogs. We just didn't click for whatever reason. So I placed them with another team or group, and they did great.
And she emphasized, not only is it important to find a dog that's a good fit for you, it's also just as important to consider what line of work you'd like to pursue with your canine partner. When it comes to training human remains detection dogs or cadaver dogs, there are countless possibilities.
Again, the cadaver work, law enforcement, which is multitask, such as bite work, tracking, drug work, bomb detection, article search, and then you have search and rescue. You have the wilderness, which is the woods and mountains. You have water, which is lakes and rivers. So, and then you have area search, which is dogs that search, you know, large fields, and then the tracking itself. All of those have some similarities, but they have some very big differences. So you want to make sure that you decide exactly, well, not only do I have the right dog, but it's the right dog to do the kind of things that I want to do, because not every dog can do certain things. So some dogs are much better at tracking. Some are much better at, in fact, we have to evaluate these dogs for cadaver work to make sure that they don't have what we call an aversion to it, meaning they're scared to death of it. It's not a training issue. It's not socialization. It's a natural reaction that some dogs, and it's very rare, but I've seen it, and you have to immediately eliminate them as a cadaver dog candidate.
First and foremost, Trace says whether a canine handler is a police officer or volunteer in search and rescue, he or she provides services and resources to families and officials. It doesn't matter if they're getting paid or not.
And with that, it takes a lot of dedication. It's very expensive. It's very time consuming. You need to be in great physical condition. The dog needs to be in great physical condition. It's long hours. It can be very dangerous at times. It can be very emotionally draining. There's so many, I don't want to say negatives, because I don't like to say about the negative parts, but the reality of it is people see, you know, these 5-second, 10-second clips on the news and think, oh my gosh, that's so cool. I'd like to do that. But there's so much more to it. For example, these dogs are Olympic athletes, and they need to be trained in that kind of physical condition because people's lives are at stake. And then you yourself staying in top physical condition. And then just the sacrifices with your family and friends. There's been many times I've not been able to participate in family events because I've been involved in cases. So having that support as well. I would say to emphasize this, there are a lot of things that people do with their dogs, and they're wonderful things, whether it's competition for AKC or show dogs or whatever it might be. This is very different, that this should not be considered a hobby. This should be considered a profession and almost an obsession, because people's lives are at stake. So that's the one big notation I should pass, you know, I want to pass along to the listeners.
That's so fascinating. And you saying all that, it's really hitting me as someone who is a huge animal lover, especially dog lover. You know, it takes more than that. The passion for animals, of course, I'm sure has to be there, but that there's so many more layers and facets and so much more to it. And you mentioned what you encounter day to day, especially, you know, in your investigatory work. And kind of in that same vein, I was going to ask you, what was the first, you know, case that you worked on with a canine? And over the years, what cases have stood out to you in particular, kind of more in the true crime realm, that, you know, you said this has been a huge sacrifice for you, but you're saving lives and you're helping people hopefully get closure, depending on the case. So what has that been like? So, what was the first case and maybe a few other cases that have stood out to you in your line of work?
So the first two cases that come to mind, one was a live person, the other one was a deceased person. The live person was an older lady. She had Alzheimer's. She had wandered away from her home about a quarter of a mile away is where we found her. She was very close to the edge of a pond. She had slipped and fallen in some slippery, muddy area. And she was okay. She was a little cold, but we were able to find her and get her out of there. The interesting part about that one is it was about 30 minutes later, a three or four tornado came through that area. So we were able to get her and the other, you know, everybody, all the personnel out of that area before the tornado hit. I remember as soon as I arrived back home, these incredible size hail was starting to hit as soon as I stepped in. So that's what really sticks out for me on the first one. The second one was, again, the first time I had ever seen someone dead like that and someone murdered. As they were. And this gentleman was dismembered by his brother. And I remember I was so young, and I have to say, so naive. I think it's important to share with you and the listeners. When I started this, probably the best thing that helped me is I was young, dumb, stupid, naive, full of passion, full of energy, full of life, full of, you know, just this wide-eyed kid of, wow, this is amazing, and to do these incredible things with my dog. So the officer showed me where the house was, and on the front porch was this man, and I found out later on it was the victim's brother. And what I remember the most, the house was out from the road probably 50 yards or more, and it was in a rural area. And he was sitting on this chair and he was smoking a cigarette. And I remember the only thing I could see was the whites of his eyes and a little bit of the puff of smoke coming up his face. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up, even though he was 50 yards away. That was my first experience of true evil. And if people ask, is there really evil in the world? And I would say, absolutely, yes. And he was my first experience in that. So as we start looking for what happened to his brother, we're going down the road. There's this something on the side of the road. You couldn't really tell what it was because it was wrapped in comforter and sheets and whatevers. And the dog responded to it. And when we opened it up, there was no head. There was no legs. And the only way you could tell that it was a human was that there was some type of bindings around his wrist. And I remember the steep embankment, the dog starts wanting to jump and had trouble getting up it because it was so steep and so tall. So I pushed the dog up and then we climb over and there's these black garbage bags. And the dog starts responding to it. And I remember the officer behind me, he said, how did he say it? Do we have a positive? So I lifted up the very edge of the bag where it was tied. And when I lifted it up, just to paint a picture of what, you know, what you can encounter in these things, all of these maggots poured out from the underneath the bag. And I was like, yeah, we have a positive.
Can you imagine? I mean, talk about diving right in for that to be her first experience in this line of work. And Trace said, you know, it was shocking. They would later find out the killer shot and dismembered his brother in hopes of taking his house from him. They would also later find out through interviews with the suspect that he intended on killing not only his brother that day, but the rest of his family who were living at the house. Gave me chills. Trace said that while it was, of course, unbelievably shocking and, you know, traumatic to go through that experience, coming face to face with evil that day only emboldened her to help with more investigations. And one, I mean, how admirable, But I had to wonder, you know, while she's motivated, how do you keep your canine officer motivated in the same way?
Dogs, a lot of the dogs that people see or hear about is like drug dogs, bomb dogs, cadaver dogs, things like that. These dogs actually don't find bombs, bodies, or drugs. They find scent. None of these dogs have any concept that they're finding these things. What they're actually looking for is their toy or some type of reward. So I do get that question, do the dogs get depressed or, you know, really down or, you know, those kind of emotions? And I say absolutely not. They love this because, for all due respect, it's like an Easter egg hunt for them. Because they know when they find that scent, it's like, wow, good things, fun things happen. That's, they get to play with their ball, you know, get all these, this attention and everything. So just to clarify that, dogs don't get depressed. And I've never had a situation where my dogs, you know, we would have to retire them because they're just too sad or, you know, PTSD kind of thing, you know, finding dead people. Now, bombs is a different story that has more to do with the overstimulation and, you know, the fear of hearing the big kaboom. So there are some dogs that do that line of work that do have PTSD. But in regards to cadaver dogs, they do not. It's actually a very fun game for them, so to speak. The true terminology of these dogs is actually human remains detection dogs, HRD. And the reason why is, well, they find so much more than just dead people. They find, of course, a full-size body to skeletal remains and then everything in between. And that could be even things that are, quote, non-criminal. Like oftentimes when we're searching a home or even a business, but most likely in most cases it's a home, I'll ask, are there any menstruating females that live in this home? Because if you think about it, when you use tampons or feminine products, that is human remains to a dog. So that's non-criminal. And I would also like to emphasize with cadaver dogs, when they respond to an area, it does not automatically mean that a crime has happened there or a crime has happened at all. Cadaver dogs do two things for us at all times. They either tell us where something is and where something isn't. And I have found in this line of work, knowing where something isn't is just as helpful and as important as knowing where something is. Of course, our goal is to find the person and or evidence. But what our typical process is, we may search in many places and not find anything, but it still moves the case forward. So all of that really plays into from an investigative perspective. And it's the same thing with human investigators. Very rarely do human investigators get a full confession, get where the body is, get all of that. They have to go through many interviews, search many places. They have to do a lot of things before the aha moment happens. So when we talk about when the dogs have a positive, it's actually an alert or indication. So to go through the transition of, let's say a dog is searching an area, I'm actually looking for what we call a COB, change of behavior. So every dog has a certain change of behavior when they get into the scent that they have been trained to detect. And it's really important for a handler, and I tell other canine handlers doing workshops that you need to know, and your responsibility is really very short. And that responsibility is first and foremost safety, safety for you, your dog, and anybody with you. Secondly, is getting your dog in, quote, a favorable and at least increase the odds of the dog detecting scent. And then thirdly, knowing when your dog is in scent and out of scent 100% of the time. So when the dog has a change of behavior, and I found that oftentimes is more important than, quote, the final alert, is that when they're having a change of behavior, they may pick up that scent just in a half a second. I was like, oh, wait a minute, they did something here.
And that's when Trace says she'll take her dog back, even in another direction, to see if they pick up more of a scent. And the final alert can be all sorts of trained behaviors, a sit, a bark, laying down, or a scratch, all to say, I'm picking up scent at this spot right here. It's also fascinating. So picking back up in our conversation, I asked her about cases she's working on now. And one in particular she mentioned recently brought her all the way from Georgia to Texas.
Well, Nicole, you mentioned the Texas case. I just got back from Texas. That was a gentleman that disappeared a couple of years ago, and his whereabouts are still unknown. What we learned from that is a great example is that we were able to clear a lot of areas. We did 8 separate areas, and we know where he's not. And that's something that when I talk with officials and families, I will say, I can only promise you one thing when we're doing these things. And that is, I will tell you, we will be able to move this case forward somehow, some way at the end of the day. And that is very helpful from the family, from an emotional perspective, and then from the investigators, from an investigative perspective. Other cases, so working with all these agencies, I've worked with many different agencies from the FBI, fugitive task forces, local agencies, state agencies, and that oftentimes it's law enforcement, but also fire departments, emergency management agencies, of course, families themselves. So just in a nutshell, I have truck, have dog, will travel kind of concept. Other cases that I have really stick out for me. So Meredith Emerson, she was a hiker that was abducted and killed here in Georgia. Luke Dillard was a 3-year-old boy that disappeared. And Chase Massner, which is the Iraqi war veteran that was found 3.5 years later, Hurricane Katrina, everybody's heard of that. We were able to, in that situation, we actually went down to New Orleans, down in what they call Ground Zero. The sugar plant disaster, that was very unique and memorable, that happened here in South Georgia down by the coast. And then a number of battlefield sites that I have worked on and have some coming up that includes the Civil War, but also Revolutionary War. Whenever I get a call from an agency, we're ready and able, and the dogs stay in top condition, and I work with them practically every day. Not so much training, but I spend time with them every day because there is a bond and a relationship that is so important in doing this kind of work.
Overall, Trace said she's helped with more than 2,000 cases during her career. Another one she mentioned was a case involving Eleanor Alexander. Eleanor was an Alzheimer's patient who'd been missing for 4 days when Trace and her dog Cinco got involved. Trace and Cinco found Eleanor in about 35 minutes. And you heard Trace mention Luke Dillard, a 3-year-old boy who disappeared. I wanted to hear more about her work on that case in particular. And it turns out there was a connection to, of all people, actor Dean Cain. So for those not familiar, he's probably most famous for playing Superman in the 90s, 1993 to 1997, to be exact. But in 2010, Dean Cain starred in a movie called The Way Home, based on a true story about a little boy's disappearance. Trace and her dog Cinco are featured in the movie in a scene with Dean Cain, who played the father of the missing boy. As Trace was in the middle of shooting that movie, she receives the call about Luke Dillard's case. And Luke was from Georgia. He'd been missing all day when Trace got the call, in an area about 20 minutes from where she was living at the time.
So I went, searched for him, and they've been searching for him like, 8-10 hours all day, and it was probably about 10:30 at night. And Cinco actually found him in about 30 minutes. And I'll never forget it, because when he ran off, well, he went up this hill, and then he stops, and he's just looking at me, and I'm like, all right, Cinco, why are you stopping, and why are you looking up at me? Well, this is one thing I would say to anybody that does this, any kind of work: trust your dog, even when it doesn't make any sense. So as I'm looking at him, right next to him, I see this movement, and this little boy looks up at me, he had covered himself up with leaves and branches, didn't even see him, even though I'm like 2 feet from him. And he looks up at me with these big old eyes. And I pick him up, and he's very cold. And I tell the officer to sit down and just put your arms around him. Let's try to warm him up. I had some clothes in my backpack. So I put him, like, my socks were big enough to really be pants for this little boy. So as we're doing all of this, Cinco's reward is like a ball. And I give him the ball. Well, Cinco comes up and drops it right by the officer and the little boy. So the little boy has not said a word. So he picks up the ball and he kind of tosses it to Cinco. So we have this incredible, special, wonderful interaction between this dog and this little boy.
What an incredible interaction to witness. And admittedly, I got a little emotional at that point in our conversation. I'm a huge dog lover. Shout out to my dog, Aspen. Dogs are just the best. So Trace said Luke continued to play with Cinco throughout the rest of the night. And shortly after, he was brought to an ambulance, reunited with his family. She said their joy was palpable. They cheered. It was unlike anything she'd experienced before. So pan to 2 days later, she's back on the set of The Way Home with Dean Cain, giving new meaning, she said, to the expression life imitates art. She told the director about her experience with Luke Dillard's case in between filming, and it wasn't long until her story spread throughout the cast and crew, and she was approached by the star of the movie.
So I'm back in this area where they have little foods and snacks and stuff, and you know, I'm just having a little snack and I hear this tap, feel this tap on my shoulder, and I turn around and it's Dean Cain. And he said, I have a son and I'm making this movie and I heard what you did. And this has just been one of the most heartwarming, but heartbreaking, you know, emotional experience I've ever had. And he hugged me and he's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, you really do these kind of things. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful person.
And Trace said she called her mom, who was so proud of her. She told her the whole story. But of course, she also asked, could I maybe come on set and meet Dean Cain? So thankfully, Trace said the cast and crew made that happen. And in that same vein, she reminded me it was one of the more positive experiences she's had in her career. Oftentimes, cases don't pan out that way, and she doesn't disclose details about her work to her loved ones, so they won't worry. There are plenty of experiences she shouldn't have lived through, but thankfully, she did. And in her day-to-day, Trace said she's encountered bizarre cases, like the disappearance and murder of Army veteran Chase Masner. In December 2018, James Bradshaw Clement, who goes by Brad, was sentenced in the death of 26-year-old Chase Masner, whose remains were found a year earlier behind a Kennesaw home where Brad used to live. Chase Masner, a father of two, went missing in March 2014. Reports say he and his wife were arguing that day, and she left him at a QT near Brad's home. Chase's wife reported him missing soon after she couldn't get a hold of him. Even though investigators believed Chase went over to Brad's home, he reportedly denied knowing where Chase was. Prosecutors later said he gave changing stories concerning the circumstances surrounding Chase's disappearance. Brad moved out of the house several months later. A newlywed couple bought the property and completely renovated the home. In 2017, after receiving a new tip, authorities contacted Trace. And while her dog didn't seem to get hits inside Brad's home, investigators said they found a suspicious anomaly in the woods near Brad's house. So that's where we'll pick up, where Trace is describing how she got involved with Chase Masner's case.
The dog goes right by it. Well, what it happened to be was this huge yellow jacket's nest. So me and the dog, and I think a few others got, you know, stung quite a bit. And as we're coming back up toward the house, I'll never forget it. I look at the detective and I said, You know, I'm just one of those people that I rather do too much than not enough. And I'm sure you've heard of this, Nicole, CYA. So we like to do, as much CYA as possible. But in all the cases I work, I always approach it from the standpoint, did me and the dogs do everything we could possibly do to make sure that whatever we're looking for is not here? And if it is here, that we find it. So that's why I go oftentimes above and beyond, even to the extreme. So we check inside the house, we check behind the house in the wooded area in this specific location. But as we're walking up, I said, let me just check all the boxes and let's check around the house just while we're here. So as we're coming up to the house, I said, all right, I'm going to start the dog at the front of the house in the front yard and then just have them check around. So the dog goes up to the house, turns to the left of the house, goes around, goes to the back of the house. And the way the topography is that the far end of the right side of the house, the deck is about, there's the space of about 3 feet between the bottom of the deck and the top of the dirt. So the dog goes around, doesn't do anything, but when it gets to this deck area, it goes underneath and it has a very, very clear change of behavior. Both of these dogs were experienced, had found multiple dead bodies. So I clearly knew their change of behavior. It was obvious. So I don't say anything. And everybody, you could have heard a pin drop. And I said, well, I'm going to go get the second dog and I'm going to work them the exact same route. And let's see what the second dog does. Second dog does the exact same thing. So the dogs are telling us two distinct things. We go inside the house. Basement, first floor, second floor, nothing. We go to the woods, same thing there. But when they get to the back of the house by this deck, they're having a clear, distinct change of behavior and they are both alerting. So we look and there's some lattice that's lying underneath the deck where this couple had stored some extra lattice that they had that they were using for other projects. And you can look through the holes of a lattice and you can see through it, and we're seeing concrete. And I'm thinking, all right, well, maybe it's the septic tank because dogs will alert to septic tanks because this was a young female that, was menstruating. So, that's something that's not uncommon for them to respond to a septic tank. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. I don't know much about construction, but a septic tank shouldn't be 2 feet from a house, should it? And then we were thinking, well, is this where a patio was going to be placed, but they decided to put a deck instead? We were thinking everything but a body. I mean, really, we had no idea that anybody would be there. So what I tell them, guys, based upon the dog's response, we cannot determine that this area is officially cleared. And in my professional opinion, based upon the dog's reactions to this specific area, it warrants further investigation. About 30 days later, I get an email after working all day. I turn on my computer, not expecting, really anything of interest. And I see this email and I thought, that name sounds familiar. So I pull it up and it's like, oh, that's the detective. So I have this email. I've saved it and it's very short. He said, Trace, just want you to know the dogs were right. Chase was right where they alerted. Good dogs. Good job. Thanks. And that was it. And I was like, oh my gosh. So we theorize anyway, because Brad, from what I understand, has not told the whole truth, but theorizing of what possibly happened. Brad did have a criminal record, and that Chase went over there, was taking drugs, possibly overdosed, or maybe, bad drugs. We don't know. Brad finds this man, Chase, dead in his house, and he's like, oh my gosh, I can't report it because they're going to charge me with this. So his approach to solving this problem is to bury Chase in the backyard. Prior to that, he had wrapped Chase in one or two tarps and then literally mummified him with duct tape, wrapped his whole body in duct tape. placed the body in this grave, covered it up with dirt, covered it up with concrete, and Chase was there for 3.5 years. And I would say probably the thing that frustrates me the most is that there is a video out there of Brad and Chase's mother, Stephanie, sitting there. And Stephanie, this poor mother, it is heart-wrenching, begging and pleading through tears. Where is my son? Where did you see him? What did he say? I mean, all of these raw emotions. And Brad is saying, I don't know where he is. And that to me is, something that is just inhumane, absolutely inhumane to have this mother suffer like that. And he knew very well what had happened to Chase. So, and exactly where he was.
I told Trace I could identify with how she felt. Maybe not in the same way, but being a journalist, unfortunately, you're confronted with the worst of humanity day to day. And switching gears somewhat, maybe in a more positive direction, I wanted her to tell me about all the dogs she's worked with over the years, or as many as possible. Trace said she considers them all partners, companions, but so much more.
They're a family. They're a confidant. I can't tell you how many times when I'm retired law enforcement, I would be on patrol and just having a bad day, I would talk to my dog because I know my secrets were safe with him, and just the therapy of it. And you talk about dogs, how incredible they are. Nicole, I got to say, we don't deserve dogs. We really don't. We're not special enough to have such incredible beings share our lives and be able to share our lives with them. And for them to be in our lives, we just don't deserve them. So, Zach was my first dog, to talk about just having a really big stumbling block and doing this kind of work. If you do this long enough, you're going to have complete total heartbreak. Zach, as passionate as I was, he was a gorgeous dog, but he had a rare degenerative disease. And at 2.5 years old, we had to put him down. And that was horrible. I was devastated. And then I've had some other dogs and over the years pass away. And I have to say, as much as I've seen and, you know, just horrible, evil things, they're hard, but I'm not bothered by them because I know why I'm doing this, and that is for the families. So when you talk about the impact, why do I do this? And the question is, I ask folks when I'm doing seminars or whatever, it's like, when my phone rings, what do you think I think about? And they'll say, oh, what dog to take, what equipment to take, who you're searching for. And it's like, no, guys, that's my point to you. If you're not looking at it from this perspective, don't do this kind of work. And if you're doing it and you've lost sight of this, stop doing it. And that is, somebody's life has changed forever. Forever. But what I can do is everything in my power, everything in my dog's power, to help them through this darkness, give them answers, give them hope, give them the feeling that somebody truly cares. And that's why I do it. And if I ever lose sight of it, then I will not, I will get rid of the dogs, the truck, the equipment, and all of it. And when we talk about these dogs, they do so much for us. And I'll have to, I would be remiss if I don't bring up my newest dog, Taz. I'd had him DNA'd. He's a Belgian Malinois, looks just like a Belgian Malinois, but he's more stockier. And his DNA is primarily Belgian Malinois with some German Shepherd and then a little cattle dog. So you can only imagine his energy level and his intelligence level is incredible. He's called Taz because he looks like the character Tasmanian Devil. He's got that same color with the brown and the black and everything. But he literally swirls around kind of with all that energy that the Tasmanian Devil character is. But he's lovable. So I do want to share this with you, Nicole. People essentially all want and need the same thing. That's love, support, comfort, security, safety, all those kind of common basic needs. And with that, in criminal cases, missing person cases, I saw different behaviors. And that really inspired me to say, all right, wait a minute. I'm curious about a lot of things. Will the research show this? And then I realized, as long as I've been doing this, I hope to be doing this for many, many, many years. But the reality is, you know, I've got a lot of miles on these legs. And I thought, how can I do this smarter? So that's when I was inspired to get my PhD in psychology, with a focus of criminology, behavioral analysis, victimology, all of those kind of things, to figure out, all right, where do serial killers put their victims, and how do they select them, and what do they do? And then what, let's say, domestic cases, stranger cases, is it a male or a female? So I have seen all these kind of similarities and differences between different groups and different motives. Believe it or not, I've been able to help agencies that way. And they'll call me up and they said, Tracy, they were exactly where you said they would probably be. I was like, that's awesome.
Trace said her PhD journey inspired her to focus on forensic examination. And in doing so, she recently provided authorities with an assessment regarding a 13-year-old murder investigation. Following her analysis, detectives reopened the case, and it just solidified for Trace the impact she can have in law enforcement, both from a scientific and boots-on-the-ground approach. While she's not on social media, her latest dive into forensic examination did prompt her to create a website where you can follow her work, forensicinvestigations.com. She also has a podcast called The Seeker's Quest. She paused her work on the podcast while she pursued her PhD, understandably so, but she hopes to reopen it very soon. And in the meantime, you can go back and listen to her original episodes where she discusses all of the countless cases she's helped with over the years. And Trace said she's also seriously considering writing a book about her life, as well as a children's book. And if that's all not enough, she's also working on becoming a professional photographer. And of course, again, in the middle of all of this, she's still helping with investigations and agencies across the world. One case in particular that she's helping with currently stood out to me: the BTK killer. For quick background, Dennis Lynn Rader, also known as BTK, an abbreviation for bind, torture, kill, is a serial killer who murdered at least 10 people in Wichita and Park City, Kansas between 1974 and 1991. And with the help of numerous agencies and experts, including Trace, authorities are working to determine whether he could be connected to other cold and missing persons cases from that time period.
His job, in fact, jobs that he had, allowed him and required him to travel many distances, or long distances, in many different ways and many different days. So, oh my goodness, it's not like he was just a home-based, for lack of better words, serial killer, even though he did admit to 10 murders within his home base, which is where he lived with his wife and children. Who's to say that these other areas that he didn't travel to, that he wasn't involved in those cases as well? And that's the huge challenge here. Not only the timeline, but also many of these people haven't been found. Unfortunately, he's in ill health and he's much older now. So just want to make sure that if there are any other individuals that he's connected with, that we can make that happen before he passes away.
And unrelated to the BTK investigation, she also wanted to share news and updates about other cases she's helping with across the country.
Brittany Woods, this is in Alabama. She disappeared, 14 years ago. So we went over to Alabama not too long ago to help with that case. Bo James, that's the Texas case that I just came back from. Again, we didn't find him. We did meet with his parents, and we were able to give them, you know, a lot of updates and answer a lot of their questions and told them. And that's something I think it's important to share with your listeners. When we meet with these officials and families and we don't find anything in Bo James' case, tell the family that just because we didn't find him or find anything, that doesn't mean we stop. So some of these cases I've worked with for a number of years, and I'm happy to help and continue working on them for many years to come, however long it takes to find their loved ones and to find these answers. Natalie Holloway is a great example of that. I worked that case a number of years, and I will tell you, her remains will never be found. I know Vandersloot has finally admitted what happened and that he was directly involved in her disappearance and her death. So I think a lot of those questions have been answered now. Gabriella Dixon, she's down in Macon, Georgia. Beautiful young woman that disappeared. I think there's some theories about a domestic situation of being involved with her disappearance. So I've helped officials on a couple of days look for her. We have not found her yet. Matilda Gonzalez, this is the same agency that I assisted with the Chase Massner case. She has not been found yet, but because of what the dogs found, three individuals have been arrested, and that case is very active right now. Tiffany Foster, she was a beautiful mother, and her fiance has been charged with her disappearance. She, again, has not been found. And the dogs, we helped, gosh, I don't know how many places we searched for her. But the investigators have been amazing and worked very hard on that case. And hopefully we'll get some additional information on additional areas to search.
Adding to all the cases she just mentioned, Trace said she and her dogs will also be visiting three Revolutionary War battlefields to assist in identifying human remains and historic grave sites. So fascinating. She also recently got a call about a 1944 military plane crash. Investigators firmly believe there are remains where that plane crashed, and authorities have sent her an archaeological report. Many of the same plane parts from the crash are still at the site where Trace will be traveling very soon. This is Beyond Criminal Headlines. My name is Nicole Bennett. Every few weeks, you'll be able to find new episodes on any of your favorite podcast providers featuring conversations between myself and experts who've investigated some of the most notorious crimes in our history. And you can follow the podcast on Facebook. It's at Beyond Criminal Headlines. And I definitely, of course, plan to keep in touch with Trace. I will keep you all updated on the cases that she's working on and anything else that she has to share with us going forward. You can, again, follow that all on Facebook. And also, don't forget, wherever you're listening right now, give the podcast a rating, review, subscribe, follow, so you don't miss an episode. I hope you learned something from this week's episode featuring my conversation with renowned dog handler, among so many other incredible things, Trace Sargent. We'll be back again soon. Until next time, this is your host for Beyond Criminal Headlines, Nicole Bennett, signing off.